Great. We're joined by Juan Delgado Moreira, co-CEO at Hamilton Lane. Welcome.
Thank you.
So to kick off, tell us a little bit about Hamilton Lane and, you know, your background.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Hamilton Lane is now the largest private market investment management firm. We are operating out of 23 countries with over $924 billion in investment advice. We're a private market specialist. I've been the co-CEO for all of this year. Prior to that, I was a vice chairman. I've been in the firm for over 20 years. I come from the investment backgrounds. Prior to that, I was another private equity firm as a general partner. I'm currently based in Hong Kong for the last 14 years, operating a global role with my co-CEO, Eric Hirsch.
Fantastic. And we'll come back to the Asian market a little bit later. The first thing I wanted to start with was actually tokenization.
Sure.
Because this really caught my eye. We've heard asset managers in the UK, only a couple really talk about tokenization. I think to a lot of people, it still seems like something that's a little bit in the future, a little bit futuristic. It's not really so far changing things, but you have a tokenized fund. So it'd be great to start off explaining, what is it?
Yeah.
What is it? How does it work? And what does it do?
I think we can start with why do it? Why bother? What are the challenges? The challenges are that we, as much as anybody, since we're private market experts, operate a business where, first of all, retail investors have no access to, which kind of, if you think about it, is unfair. It's quite the fastest growing, largest asset class where retail investors have no access. Second, if they did or when they do, they require very large minimum amounts of capital. They commit to very illiquid, long-dated structures. The structures are completely over-the-counter. You need to sign, fill out an 80-page subscription document. None of that is ideal. My partner compared that to going to a grocery line to pay for your groceries and stop everybody because you're writing a check. It used to happen in the U.S. decades ago. Not anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So now, if we are committed to really bringing these type of investments to retail, a lot has to change. And we've been out in the market looking at technology innovations. The one that is by far the most promising, accomplishing cheaper, faster, better, has been tokenization. So we don't come to this as we are born native of crypto. That is not what we are saying. We analyze every technology on its merits and can it transform private market access? And we clearly assess that tokenization has the potential to do that. And so we are, we partner with well-known leaders and platforms in the world. We've tokenized four funds, not just one. We have six platforms, and we can verify and demonstrate that the technology works, that you get lower minimums, that you get more liquidity, that you get broader access, and you are able to transfer without the 80-page document. So all of that works. Now, to your second question, if I may, has adoption been amazingly transformative? No, not yet. I'll give you a chance to come back to that question. But the technology itself is really well developed. And we're no longer on tokenization 1.0. We're probably about tokenization 3.0. We can talk about what that means.
If I was to try and tell someone what the difference between a tokenized fund is versus what exists at the moment.
Yeah.
What's the simple way of explaining that?
I think that's fair. I think we shouldn't bother in the sense, that's why I answer you that way, because to the investor that accesses private markets through a tokenized offering in the future, he or she will not care about the technology that underpins that. I'll give you another analogy from another world. You and I don't care that the shares of any public company we buy are not really delivered to your mail as a paper certificate. Nobody does that. But that used to be the case. There was a register and you used to get a paper of this is one share of name a company and you put it away in your safe. That was the case. And today they are dematerialized. The register is all digital. And when they transfer, no papers get signed or countersigned. I just want to stress it to the audience. As you know, we run billions of dollars when papers need to be signed and countersigned. Wet signature, change pages, stacks of papers are delivered. So to a person who comes to this, say tomorrow, and accesses through an app, a fund, let's say a Hamilton Lane fund, I think tokenization is not going to be part of the explanation. I think the explanation is going to be, do you know Hamilton Lane? Yeah. Do you understand private markets? Yes. Do you know Hamilton Lane? Yes. Have you ever seen this performance? You invest in, say, $1,000, click here, done. The underpinning back technology that allows that dematerialization and that transferability is going to be blockchain. It's going to be tokenization. But it's not going to depend on us explaining to them, oh, look, we created a feeder here, we issued tokens, one-to-one backed by this. That's already too complicated. That's for the experts, I mean. But that's not going to be the key to adoption of tokenization.
Brilliant. This is distributed ledger technology that is establishing ownership of...
It is essentially the use of blockchain to have ownership, effectively true ownership, that doesn't require the direct ownership of a physical asset, owns it through the tokens.
And
that they are backed by those one-to-one, and that they are therefore more easily transferable. They can fractionalize. So whereas a commitment at a certain size can be divided in smaller fragments. And all of that is not crypto. I would argue all of that it doesn't add a layer of leverage of any other financial consideration risks. It is just a pure digitization using the blockchain of a private market's interest.
So you said you have four strategies. So just my question would be, what are those? And who is the market for those? Who is buying that at the moment?
Yeah. Essentially, we've tokenized the four, as it happens, different vehicles, because we have US and non-US. So I'm counting four different vehicles, but let's say two distinct type of strategies. One that at the risk of sounding like marketing, when you look at these afterwards, that is for us an all-weather balanced, equity-oriented exposure to private markets, which in the non-tokenization world has the name of global private assets. And another one that is more credit-oriented, that is more senior, which has, again, in the non-tokenized world, is called Scope. So those are the two main type of strategies. They are evergreen in nature, and those are the two in offering, both on the US and non-US versions. That's how you end up with the four offerings. The market is, our current state of play has been really to assess which ones are the best platforms. You want to have the best partners in the market. The platforms are different in the US, in Europe, or in Asia. So we've gone through these years of vetting them, analyzing them. We've been shareholders on a number of them and partnering with the best platforms. They themselves are the ones who have underlying client bases that we can talk about.
Okay. And so what name of some of those platforms?
Yeah, no, it's public. We Securitize, Libre, right. Signum, Hadex, yeah.
Fantastic. And so how much of you money have you made out of this so far? And, you know, I would ask, why are we not seeing more people do this?
Yeah. No, I to the first question, not material. To the second question, I do think that the adoption among us as managers is picked up significantly. I mean, the biggest now tokenized fund in the world is run by very well-known firms that everyone knows. So we no longer, in the space of these last quick 3 years, we no longer feel alone as being the only one. Why you guys are doing this? Or, you know, nobody else. That's not the case. The largest funds are now hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. So scale is picking up. Brands are all coming to the platforms. And I think the key element in your question is, what is the pace of adoption and what is that curve going to look like? And I think, again, back to the analogy of payments, you know, it took multiple decades to go from writing a check to going to Apple Pay, right? That is essentially an exponential curve, potentially. We are on early stages of that adoption. But again, I'd say the technology is ready to scale up already. I think it's about the customer experience. You have to focus on the customer experience. If you and I use Apple Pay, it's because it's so good and our experience is so much better. So clearly today, we still have to get to the B2C element. We're on the B2B element of this phase, and we're able to really pipe a much better experience to wholesalers. Those platforms need to access and deliver that service to their customers.
And you think it's something that will allow people on very modest means to be buying tiny fractions of these investments?
Yes. I mean, that is what's designed and meant to do. There's only two barriers to that, but I think it's in the spirit of your question. Number one is regulatory. The regulator is who dictates who can buy this. Is technology is going to enable us to bring that closer, but at some point in the different jurisdictions, the regulator determines how you can access or not an accredited investor at retail. It's not the tech itself. And I think that's something that will be changing in the near term. And then I have not deliberately used the word democratization. I don't think that should be, and you don't see it in the market as often. I think it has all these sort of connotations that make it sound like we are in a particular political party or anything like it. But we do firmly believe as a firm, that's why we bother, that if I can buy a share and people of very little means can buy one share in Apple, just to pick a non-financial services company, and hope that that, you know, goes to double their money or so, why would they not be able to buy interest in the private market digital offering?
Fantastic. Well, we'll move on from tokenization to the world of wealth management. So I've got Hamilton Lane in. I've got to ask you about the thing that we write about all the time, which is private assets being sold via wealth managers and being, you know, targeted to that market. What are wealth clients, as in the businesses themselves, buying? How are they using private assets right now? Mm. What is that market?
Yeah. That market has, I'm not playing the fifth. We've only met today, but I'm not being defensive at all. I think it's really important. That market is a pull factor market, meaning the private wealth management firms have come to us, the managers, to say, we want what you have. It's not a push market. And I can argue that if you feel otherwise, but I think it's important to realize that firms like ours are this massive institutional business where very large asset owners in the world have been invested in private markets for decades. For decades. We have data that goes back to the 70s, right? We have, you know, $15 trillion of data through our books going back 50 plus years. This is not new. What we do is not new. So what is new is this arrival of private wealth platforms pulling from that established landscape of private managers and say, well, we want to be able to access that. We want to be investing like endowments, like pension plans. How do we do that, right? So I think that's point number one. It's a tremendous pull factor. Then, of course, you are called to make decisions, right? Are you everywhere? Are you in all supermarket platforms? Are you curating your offering? But the pool has been very strong for over the last few years, and the market has now converged largely on which structure is optimal for that market, and that is the so-called evergreen structures that we can talk about. Again, that is completely now today market-wide. That is a consensus. The fees are in a range, but the design of a structure is not really up for debate. It's really quite established and set. And so now you have the demand, you have the structure, and then you have the offering. And by and large, I'd say we started 5 years ago, so we're one of the largest and oldest in this segment. In 2019, one of our flagship funds has come off 5-year performance levels. I'd say by and large, the early days of this on the offering side were flagships, like absolutely what is our best all-weather program. Quite comparable if you go back to the design of the takeoff of the mutual fund, right? In the beginning, it was like the bulge bracket, one fund for the world. And then you saw an explosion of offering. And I think we've completed those first 4 years with very few products and very established kind of flagship type of offerings. And what we're seeing today, which is part of your question, is that next phase of you go from flagship to all flavors, from vanilla to all flavors, and the market explodes in terms of offerings, right? There's no question of who's at fault. It's a natural demand supply. The private wealth channels continue to ask for more product, and the issuers are having to face that decision. And that's where we are right now at the moment.
Now, very interesting. So talk about pull factor, first of all. I suppose my question, or the question it raises in my mind, is what are they asking for? So I can understand wealth managers wanting higher levels of return, but if they're also demanding, hoping for a commensurate level of liquidity, that just doesn't come with that return, doesn't come with the nature of investments, then there may be a pull factor, but they're asking for something that you can't deliver.
That is impossible. Yeah, I think that the industry by and large struggle with that question because it is a correct theoretical question. And I can tell you about research groups that the indices and the largest banks and managers in the world put together to try to solve that conceptually and analytically. So what gives? What gives is the fact that you've now gone through 50 years of data and we all have pretty good data on which strategies within the private markets generate which natural liquidity. What do I mean by that? I mean that if we invest in a certain type of short duration private market investing, yes, it's not liquid on demand yesterday, but I know that it's going to generate, say, 20-25% level of distributions on an annual basis. I can model that. I have 50 years of that data going through all the cycles that I've gone through. If I combine that with some credit, and we've been seeing the explosion of direct lending in credit, now I have some yield to come with that. If you have a strong support from credit facilities, I can have a backstop line for enhanced liquidity. So you can put together portfolios because the growth of the asset class gives you more choices. It's no longer like a one buyout fund of the former like a venture, super liquid venture capital fund. How are you going to get that liquid? You have a much wider, bigger asset class with many more options, many more choices, many more funds. And the portfolio construction process has gotten better. And you can model that. That is where that liquidity comes from and has come from it. I think it's just important to highlight that although we are on a nascent takeoff phase, we've not started yesterday. People dismiss my comment of 5 years. Oh, Juan, thank you, 5 years. Oh, wait. That was COVID. We survived COVID, the panic of Q1, February, March 2020. We were up and running for a year. You survived the adjustment pause. You survived the takeoff of growth and valuations. You survived the crisis, the interest rate hike. So these structures generate a level of liquidity which the institutional side knew and had experience, and now we'll have the data to model better. In addition to that, the structures are designed to limit essentially the potential required liquidity in cases of in events of crisis. But they've been tested, and so that's where that liquidity comes from. The rate of return that is expected is exactly as you said it. I expect a private market's rate of return. There's no compromise on that. Right, so that's where we are. That's the promise, and that's the premise on which these investments are taking place. And by the way, I would say it's not an easy market. Sometimes coverage on these interviews, because you have this growth in allocation, it gives you the false sense that investing must be easy because you know they're raising like wait. It's not an easy market to invest. You look at your own. You look at the headlines. You have lower levels of investment pay. That's challenging. You have lower levels of liquidity for the last couple of years. That's challenging. So I'd say you're witnessing the growth in these structures and this channel at a time when investing is hard. And so someone must be doing something right that we're able to accommodate that.
Yeah, that's, it's so interesting when we polled our own readers or the selectors, it covers a broad church of business types, but something like 49% said, yes, we want more access, but liquidity is a problem. When we asked them whether they're trade-off, whether they were trade-off return for greater liquidity, 66% said they would, which I thought was surprising.
Yeah, I think that's, it's not surprising to us. And I think that reality will result, and this is now me entering into forecasting territory for the market, say, not a Hamilton Lane forecast. As such, but I do think that, and I think that that's a great data point, credit to your research, and that's not affecting the structures already being offered, which answered to the question that you asked me earlier, which is they are delivering a higher level. But if an industry is told that 66% would rather have more liquidity, what I think will happen over the next 5 years, and in part thanks to technology, is that you may see the industry move from monthly to daily liquidity. There's structure in the US trying to get to daily liquidity. And at some point, the cost of that liquidity is going to have to impact returns to a greater scale. And so careful what you wish for, because you might get it, I would say to your correspondents, in the sense that that if the desire is that the experience shall be as liquid as the liquid markets, then clearly there will have to be a cost for it. And I think you're absolutely right. But that's not the experience of the last 5 years. And that might be new design structures in the US, interval funds and others, that will offer at a cost a certain level of daily liquidity.
Yeah. Thank you. In terms of, I guess, what people are allocating, just quickly, have you any insight into the type of private assets?
Sure.
Because we tend to group it as alts, public equities, public bonds, private assets. So the type of assets.
Totally fair.
And what that might be displacing in portfolios.
What we think has happened already, or is happening at the moment, is that the whole allocation to alternatives or private assets is being unpacked. Mm-hmm. That's already happening, and more of that to come. And in that unpacking process, people are taking essentially a rotation from liquid equity to illiquid equity. And so what is the allocation to, say, equity-oriented evergreen structures coming from? It's coming from public equities. But at the same time, they are doing the same with fixed income. And so what is the allocation to credit in evergreen or others coming from? It's not coming from equity dollars. It's coming from fixed income. So you're actually seeing a much more thoughtful public to private rotation in allocation, and is resulting in overall increases of private markets allocation. But part of it is because it's no longer done the way it used to be done, which is I would go into a room like this and I would be asking you, what's your private markets allocation? And if you told me 3%, that was like a rule. Will is 3%, and that's set in stone. Whatever I do in my illiquid world has to fit within your 3%. That's no longer the case. That's where that allocation is coming from. So from that point of view, the 60-40 might not be dead, but it's not going to be 60, 30, and 10 in alternatives. It's going to be half of your 60 is public, half is private on the equity piece, on the whole, the same on the fixed income side. That's where it's coming from. And so that's why we've said that we think actually private markets can go to 50% of portfolios, not because the risk goes down, but because the CIO, like in your position, is saying, okay, Juan, yeah, I get it. And the public equities market, I'm getting this concentration. These sectors, I quite like this product on the private equity version of that. And I'm rotating public to private. So I'm trading in the liquidity, just as you mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. You've seen that across the range, including obviously in real assets, including in infrastructure, not just staying with the equities and credit side.
It's really interesting points made to me a couple of times in the last few months about risk budgets.
Yeah.
And I think recently someone said, the selector saying, I don't want to, I'm going to reduce my, small cap allocation for some unlisted priority. The manager was a bit upset, but it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because you might be saying, well, yes, okay, small cap's pretty risky. These private assets pretty risky. But actually, they're two different types of things, because those small caps are going to be much more liquid. And so you're dealing with a risk budget, but different types of risk within that as well. So it's a new world.
I like that way you frame that. I think there is confusion in many situations between risk and illiquidity. I think they have to be separated. Illiquidity and the liquidity decision has to be dealt with your liabilities and connected to your duration, and is different by different type of investors. And you asked me earlier, and different asset classes. But it is an element of liquidity. Risk budgets are a separate thing. You are seeing, and you, again, back to my point, more data in private markets. So private markets, I mean, I'm not making it sound like we're perfect. Of course, we're not. And one of the areas where we were way behind was in risk budgeting and risk measurement, loss ratios, VARs, equivalent Sharpe ratios. So that's coming a long way. And that means precisely, I like your example, a manager, a CIO, one of your allocators could be looking at this and saying, small cap liquid is pretty poor. Performance is pretty bad. 60% of the Russell 2000 is not making any money. That is risk, as in that is not really growing. And I have risk on earnings and all sorts of. So not to mention, it's pretty illiquid as it is, by the way. So I'd rotate to, let's say, large cap private equity. And yes, my illiquidity goes up, but I could make the case that my equity risk budget is actually lower. To your point, just following that through to conclusion. And then it's actually easier to do on the credit side, because then you have ratings. But on the equity side, to stay with, I think everyone understands now that most of the public equity exposures are very geared to the large cap, very focused on mega cap, very driven by the tech sector. And there's all this huge gaping gap here, hole that is actually quite risky. It's small cap risky. And in private markets, we have 30+% of buyout allocation that is very comparable to upper mid cap and is quite safe from an equity risk point of view. And I think more of that is coming to the market and to the thought process of the CIOs.
Yeah.
I like that.
Interesting. Well, yeah. I mentioned risk budgets.
Yep.
Then there's also real budgets, fee budgets. You know, you pulled into the world of wealth.
Yeah.
You're pulled then also into a world that has been well used to regulators talking about costs, talking about value for money, yeah. increasingly so over recent years, really intensifying in Europe, intensifying yeah. in the UK.
Yeah.
How, you know, you're going to have to adapt as well. And you know, are you feeling like your fees are well protected, so to speak? Or, you know, do you perhaps accept that you're going to have to follow that downwards if you're going to sort of continue to make growth into that market?
Well, I think that the regulators and the customers are focused on the right things. I mean, you have to have value for money. I always love that expression about the UK. And it's important. I think you have other markets, not just the UK, are very focused on total expense ratios. And we've lived under that regime for a long time. The institutional market is a very large-scale wholesale market. So they have the benefit of size to drive fee reductions. And the scrutiny on firms like us there has been very high for many, many years. That's not new at all. I would say compared to that, the bank-intermediated wealth management business had a higher fee environment, not on the public side, where, of course, the indexation has driven efficiency and compressed fees. But we are dealing in private markets, just in case your viewers need reminding of that. We're in the alpha business. There is no index in private markets. We can debate that at some point. But therefore, with absent indexation, this was a higher fee environment for alpha. And I think as you translate that to private wealth, it is a higher fee than it is on the public equities or public credit side. So you have that delta there. But scrutiny is welcome, is not new. The regulators are the same. And I think that alpha ultimately has to be net of fees. And that is, in many respects, is not new rules to firms like us. And we welcome all of that scrutiny. And I think I come back to full circle to the tokenization piece. Everyone focuses on the technology underpinnings. But one of the goals of that is technology should make access cheaper. Because it's a lot of friction in the channel that is not the manager's fee, that is cost that ultimately impacts your net return experience. So better technology, better removal of some of that friction should result in lower cost to the underlying customer.
Thank you. Well, I want to move on maybe the final few questions about distribution.
Yep.
Now, I noticed that Hamilton Lane was among others who hired distribution salespeople yep. from we might call them the traditional asset managers.
Okay.
Don't know what, perhaps you, you know, yep. why we call them traditional, yeah, but yeah, you know, yeah, sure. the likes of, well, in this case, you BNY went, and well Invesco. Yeah,
correct.
Used to be called long only investment managers.
Yep.
How valuable are these individuals' experience and networks to the wealth space, and will you be recruiting more of them?
I would say, and I've been always in private markets, I should clarify that a shortcoming of this industry was that we were all specialists of private markets. So as you are now accessing a new type of customers and a new type of financial intermediaries, these colleagues bring a wealth of experience, no pun intended in that respect, and they are really able to address the concerns, the requirements, the reporting, the monitoring, all the needs of that channel, which we didn't have in-house. So I think it's been a natural expansion of the skill set because a lot of us come from just the private market. So yes, we have for a number of years. It's not new. We also, again, if you're a private market specialist, you feel you have the knowledge and the expertise on the private market side. Therefore, we offer good training and that onboarding has been very successful. And I wouldn't say it's a question of networks or delivering books of business. It's more a question of skill sets, question of what are the requirements the protocols, the communication, and that's been a very successful integration on not just on the sales, I would say, but sales plus customer and client servicing. Yeah,
that's interesting. So not just who they know, but what they know.
It is what
they
know.
And a way of going about things.
It is what they know. What does the customer expect? So I'll give you another example, even though at the risk it sounds, I'll repeat another example. Institutions to this day are quite happy to sign an 80-page document in wet ink. Not everyone is unhappy. There's people out there who love to get a big, nice book of 80 pages marked up and then spend an afternoon reviewing that and going through their post-its to sign. Some people love it. It's their job, right? So not everyone is unhappy. In the area of expertise of these colleagues, these individuals, that's not the world. So the tolerance for that is zero. Guess what? That's what the customers want to do. More people want to work with people who really understand that's not really working well. No, we cannot ask you, Will, for 25 times your copy of passport. By the way, notarized, wet, and delivered to me. That's not reasonable. You can authenticate yourself on your iPhone. You do it every day, multiple times. And so it's what they know, is how they know what the customer experiences and expects. It's very little who they know. I think that's somewhat overhyped, or it might be tempting to think that they bring their own network. This is a market where most of the new participants are very well known asset managers within private markets like ourselves. So it's not as much about that. It's about the expertise.
And it's from our side, it does look like a little bit of an arms race with bad characterization, but
that's right.
Between yourself,
yeah,
and these so-called traditional asset managers, you know, the likes of Schroders, for example, to name check one business arbitrarily, who are themselves building up their alternatives businesses. And it feels like they are buying in the business to link to their own distribution people. You're buying in the distribution people to link to your business. So it seems, you know, while you said there's a, you know, there's this pull factor, you're going to be hiring more of these people, surely, because presumably you've got you're in competition with people who'd like their existing clients to be now buying this new thing that they've got on offer.
Yeah, I qualify that in a certain way. We are a private market manager. We're not a wealth manager. And I think that the banks and the wealth managers, whether they are bank-owned or independent platforms, will retain the client. We are just private markets. And the clients are in those platforms because they want the cross-section of all the types of asset classes. So unless firms like us, I'm just speaking about us, unless firms like us become ourselves able to be a manager, a compelling manager across the entire spectrum, we have no business or way ever taking away the client. But I'm not saying that's all of us, but that's certainly our positioning. So we are humble managers of a portion of your investment that we just discussed today. So the wealth manager will continue to bank and manage the client. But it is true that a number of them are bringing product in-house, just as we are bringing some of the expertise in-house. We're not ever even going to attempt to replace the entire network of client representatives. These are huge operations. You know, we have 700 people in total. Some of the names you mentioned and others have 700 people just in London calling clients, right? So we don't mean to scale up that way to replace that. We have people who will be servicing them, so that we help them service their customers and they will retain their customers. The last part of that you mentioned is also true. And again, it's not new. If you compare it to the public equities and the mutual fund takeoff, whoever owns the client tries to be the manager too. The banks have done that for forever, right? In different banking environments. And, you know, the jury is out there. It's not a theoretical exercise. It's actually more empirical. How many of your fund investments in your public equities investments are going to bank manage funds? Maybe not so many, right? How many of them got through banks? Maybe a lot of that. So the landscape, my bet is that the landscape on private markets will end up being not entirely dissimilar to what happened on the public equity side and the mutual fund side, which is manager expertise will continue to have its own place, and alpha generating expertise. And the distributors, some will have some in-house expertise, but they, by and large, if they want to retain the customer, they have to be open platforms. The customer wants choice, and the customers want best in class. That's not going away. You don't go to a supermarket just for one category. You go to supermarket because you want the range, right? And I think that's ultimately where the wealth platforms and the banks will retain that positioning and will be bringing the best in class private market managers like ourselves.
Briefly,
yep.
Just wanted to ask you, in terms of Europe, before we move on to Asia, just give me an idea of sort of where you're playing sort of most, and what sort of type of institutions.
We are right across the continent with existing offerings, even in the digital space, digital and wealth in the UK, in Germany, in France, in Switzerland, in Southern Europe, across the board, including both institutional and private. So completely comprehensive network of offices in Zurich and Frankfurt and London. So again, I was running this operation, as I mentioned to you privately before, since 2005. So we operated in London as a single base before Brexit, after Brexit. And so Europe is a very important business for us. And also we cover the Middle East region out of the operation connected to London.
Okay. So Asia, because I spoke to our Asia editor about this. And
yeah,
some interesting sort of questions. So a lot of, in Asia, a lot of alternative asset managers have created partnerships with some of the big private banks out there. And that's what they use their distribution teams for. Are you also taking this approach?
So we've been in Asia for 25 years, and I've been personally in Asia with my family for 14 of those years. I would say that is an easy no, meaning we have six offices. We have very local teams, over 60 professionals. And that approach to Asia has, for nearly 15 plus years, been very different from our approach to Europe. Funny, we should have this conversation as both Europeans in London. In that it's not a kind of continent or a region that you can cover at one location. So our level of localization is higher. And if you do that, then you partner with local banks. You don't partner with the mega banks, precisely because you want to be closer to differentiating books of customers. So what our landscape on the private wealth side looks like is much more regional, much more localized, much smaller in scale, much more managed by the local team. That we like that because that provides diversification, that provides access to a type of customer that is not global class wealth that banks across the global financial centers and goes to whatever is the highest loan to value, but is much more the local saver, et cetera. So that's what our business looks like. On the institutional side, our business is quite comparable to the US and the European one. It comes back, again, multi-decades, is the largest sovereign pension plans, financial institutions in that territory.
So, okay. So I think you may have answered this a little bit, but the second part of their question was, right, does that mean then that you were wanting to go to the customers more directly?
We have not made that decision anywhere, the B2C portion of that. I'm not saying that we will not, but let's just say we've decided not to take that step. That would be the best way to phrase it. So it doesn't. It means that we felt that we were better suited to do that. It was less crowded. Our teams were able to identify those partners. We were looking for partners. We believe those institutions are our partners. And so you have those local partnerships. In many of those platforms, we've been first movers. We were the first international evergreen solution that was brought to bear. We kind of like those dynamics. So that doesn't change the access experience to the customer. Still, the bank's customer or the asset manager customer in Thailand and in Singapore or in Hong Kong or elsewhere. Yeah.
Okay. And then one specific question,
yep,
was about Japan.
Yeah.
Whether you were looking to do more with Japan Wealth or establish a presence there for that, to try and serve that market.
Yeah. No, we've been in Tokyo since 2009, so long experience. Business has been institutional. We have a completely local team. Remind you that I'm the only one non-Asian in the entire Asian operation. And I think that that market has already started accessing wealth products within its own regulatory constraints. And I would say we've played it consistently with the rest of the Asia-Pacific region, which is our local team has identified leading partners. The leading partners are the banks. There is a heavily banked and well-banked market with very large institutions. In that case, it's an example where the local markets are, the local manager are actually very, very large. There's not a mid-sized regional banking environment. It's actually, they're towering giants, and we are partners with them. And that has already been going on for a number of years. So that there's no new decision for us in that respect.
Great. Well, I think we'll leave it there. Juan, thank you very much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having
me. Cheers.
Cheers.